All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. So what's going on right now? Over a month ago, thousands took to the streets all over the U.S. and in several other countries to celebrate the defeat of Trump in the national election. Trump lost. All 50 states have certified their electoral results. Trump and his allies and stooges have extended their lawsuit losing streak to 50 defeats. Is that some sort of record? So why isn't it over? Because the Trump-Pence regime is a fascist regime. Their goal has been to tear up the rules, to assault the rule of law. They have disparaged the supposedly sacred ritual of voting and called on their fascist supporters to take action. There are daily calls for civil war and pledges to die for Trump and the Republican Party, which has become a fascist party. Local and state Republican officials who have supported the rule of law have been besieged in their homes and threatened on social media. And the continuing inaction and obstruction of public health measures by the U.S. government has led to a situation where between 1,500 and 2,000 people are dying every day from COVID-19. Trump's actions have not put a stop to the process of certifying the election and going through the process of the Electoral College. But I think we all need to take this seriously. A recent article in RevCom.us has some excellent advice. People must remain vigilant to their maneuvers and attacks and active in opposing them in massive nonviolent protest when necessary. What happens in the next month and a half is critical. Everyone needs to be prepared to mobilize quickly in massive numbers against any and all attempts by the fascists to overturn the elections. At the back end of the show, we'll hear an interview with Mike Hasty, a photographer, activist, and Vietnam veteran who joined the protests in Portland, Oregon as part of the Wall of Vets. During protests in late July, he was pepper sprayed in the face by Trump's stormtroopers. He'll join us to talk about that and about the work he does with the Full Disclosure Project of Veterans for Peace. I aired this interview a few months back, but I think we all need to remember the kind of resistance that people are not only able to do, but have actually done earlier this year. And opening the show up, I will be sharing a conversation I had with Laura Briggs, the author of Taking Children, A History of American Terror. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my guest, Laura Briggs. Laura is the author of Taking Children, A History of American Terror. And I got to tell you, folks, this is an incredibly important book. It's one that's going to knock you back, and it's going to make you just, it's going to help you see what the reality of this country is and what's going on here, all right? It's an extremely important book talking about, you know, just that all of the heinous crimes that everybody thinks, it's not really that bad, is it? And you see this, and especially when it's dealing with children. And so, Laura, welcome, man. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. How about this? We start off with this. You make an opening statement. And actually it's one that in the book you make, you don't make the statement, but you print it. And it's something from Trump. It says, you have to take the children away. And that's Donald Trump. And then you introduced the horrible toll of so many children and their families as a result of all this. So many generations that have had to pay as a result of U.S. imperialism and what it's doing and people like Trump. So let's talk about that a little.
Well, thanks for asking that. One of the things that we learned in 2018 and 2019 is that when we think hard about what it looks like to take children away from their parents, and we watch it in front of cameras and in front of reporters, read about it, it is shocking and appalling. And yet, in day-to-day practice, we see it happen all around us. The foster care system takes children from parents who go to prison or parents who are judged unfit or a lot of times parents who are simply poor and who are seen as not doing an adequate job of taking care of their children. And that doesn't shock us so much. And the Trump administration made it clear that it understood this distinction for us. So in 2018, it was taking the children really as kind of a theater of cruelty. And by 2019, what we learned from the ACLU is that when they took children, it was still with the same purpose of trying to deter people who were refugees who sought to petition for asylum in the United States. And its goal was to get those parents to withdraw their petitions for asylum. But instead of saying that's the only reason they were doing it, they were saying, well, it's because his parents are neglectful or they have criminal records. And it turns out that we're much less good at standing up for parents who are accused of being neglectful or having criminal records. And the ACLU lawsuit about this pointed out, you know, some of this is just ridiculous. Like, Border Patrol agent said that a dad didn't change a diaper quickly enough and so tagged him as neglectful. But what we understand from that, or what the Border Patrol understood from that, is we're quite inured to the role of law enforcement of various sorts, including social workers, in taking children from parents. And so we have a long history in this country of using child taking as a very specific kind of cruelty to shape parents' behavior. And I'm thinking of slavery, that enslaved people regularly lost their children, and that this was, in fact, a key way of keeping women in particular from trying to escape or trying to rebel against their enslaved condition. We know that the Indian Wars were ended by taking children and putting them in boarding schools so as to ensure that Native people would stop fighting the U.S. cavalry. We know that at the height of the Civil Rights Movement, community after community began using taking children and saying that their mothers weren't keeping a suitable home was a way of punishing Black communities that were standing up against white supremacy. And we see this in Native sovereignty struggles in the 50s and 60s all the way to the present, that the more Native people struggle for the right to have their tribal courts recognized as the place where child welfare gets decided, the more we see states taking children. So we have this long history of taking children. Also, Central America, United States military played a role in training people in counterinsurgency tactics that ultimately also included taking children from so-called communists, those who were seen as a danger to U.S. interests in the region.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I know you sort of hit on this already, but I wanted to go over it again, too, because for 400 years, you're talking about 400 years, the U.S. has been living off of the blood and suffering of other people, including children. And I think a lot of people don't really understand what that means. What's, you know, the enormity of that? For 400 years, the U.S. has been living off of the blood and suffering of other people, including children. And this has had a huge impact on the character of what the USA is today and what it does in the world today.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we've been having a much more serious reckoning with the history of police violence and the role of police forces and Border Patrol being born in the crucible of racial violence, whether we look at police forces emerging out of the work of slave patrollers in hunting down fugitive people who were enslaved, or in the case of the Texas Rangers morphing into Border Patrol, their violence against and lynching of people who were of Mexican descent. But what we haven't looked at is as extensively is the role of so-called child welfare, but what I call in the book child taking, in really solidifying the kinds of racial violence that are necessary to enforce white supremacy. It isn't just a series of things that people hadn't thought of. We don't have racism in its current form because we didn't think about it right, or microaggressions or something like that. There's also real and substantive, powerful histories of racial violence that cut across many different realms in U.S. institutions.
Mm-hmm. You know, and still going off of that same thing. I mean, the fact that your book is dedicated to children who died. I mean, a lot of times people don't even think about that. You know, they think about, okay, the children have suffered. We've seen the things of the skinny kids that don't eat, they don't get any food, things like this. But this whole point that you make, that your book is dedicated to the children who died in U.S. detention centers or shortly after being released, and the children unjustly taken from their kin and caregivers. Let's talk about the impact of that and how big is this crime?
So one of the things that I was living with in a daily way as I was writing this book is sort of the presence of the children who had been taken from kin and caregivers, whether it was in the 1950s and 60s or last week, and the story of how children in U.S. Border Patrol custody were injured through the presence of epidemic disease in U.S. detention centers, including influenza, or because they arrived sick and were neglected. We saw six children die between 2016 and 2019 in Border Patrol detention, and a seventh died within a few hours of her release.
Boy, it's so enraging when you hear about the facts, and you have a certain sense of there's something evil going on in the background in this country, but then when you hear the facts about this, what you're laying out is, it's painful to hear, and it's also enraging because you're looking at this country that has pillaged the world, and then even as people try to desperately find a way to live in some manner, and they end up trying to get into the U.S., and then they face all these things. I mean, the actual idea of killing children is it's just so enraging, and it's I'm glad you wrote about it, and it's really hard to, it was hard to read, and it's also hard to hear about, but it's important that people understand what the character is of this regime and of Trump has brought to a new high or a new low what's going on and helped to push it ahead. But it's also something that, as you point out, has been going on for quite some time, 400 years. This is all the stuff that, and I think people don't recognize that very much at all, because there's sort of a way that in this country we kind of look at the past as disappeared, and it's sort of, I can't say anymore.
Right. The past is always sort of another, it's not just another country in the sense that historians talk about it, but it's something that we don't pay attention to, which is what the Trump administration in some sense was relying on in its effort to prevent refugees from Central America from applying for asylum in the United States and using the taking of children as a way to prevent that. So what does Trump say when he gets confronted about it? He says, well, Obama did it too. And what was so striking in the press response to that is they said correctly, Obama didn't do it. What they didn't also say was, and actually George W. Bush separated children from their parents in order to stop people from entering the country and applying for asylum, and that it was part of the hardening of the immigration apparatus after 9/11, 2001. And so terrorizing children and their parents, separating children and marking them as unaccompanied minors, which is a category in immigration law for people who enter the country without a parent. But instead, what the Bush administration did was separate children from their parents and then say they were unaccompanied or treat them as unaccompanied. And for that matter, we talked a fair bit in 2018 and 2019 in relationship to the Trump administration about the Flores Agreement, but we failed to comment on the fact that the Flores Agreement was an agreement that began under the Reagan administration as a set of agreements about how to treat minors. And that it actually went all the way to the Supreme Court, the question of can you incarcerate minors in ICE or immigration detention. And that the Obama administration also has its share to answer for in terms of the role of using expedited removal, which is, you know, having people, having children in particular, but all sorts of people, not allowed to have a hearing on their petition for asylum. We keep talking in this country about this as an immigration question, but it would be more accurate to say this is a refugee crisis, which is what we say when Syrians crowd the border with Turkey or with Europe and are petitioning for asylum. But when we're talking about it in relationship to the United States, we don't say, okay, these are people who are being recognized by the UN as refugees. They're in refugee shelters up and down Mexico, and they enter the United States as refugees and request asylum. And children in particular are requesting asylum. Children who are entering the U.S. as unaccompanied minors. And so in 2014, when Obama was president, we saw children entering the United States as refugees in increasing numbers, twice as many as in 2013. And the Obama administration, under pressure from the right wing, which was holding demonstrations, blaming the Obama administration for this refugee crisis, the Obama administration responded with using expedited removal. We're not going to even hear these kids' petitions for asylum. And what we know from Human Rights Watch is that a number of those children were and youth were deported to their deaths in Central America. The precise violence from criminalized police and gangs that they were trying to escape ultimately claimed their lives.
Boy. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we are talking today with Laura Briggs. Laura is a professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the author of Taking Children, A History of American Terror. You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about there's another point you make in your book, which is really important for people to understand. You know, you talk about what you've just been talking about, and then you also go on to the fact that Trump has unleashed a fascistic assault on these immigrants, the children, their parents, the other people that are involved in this. And he's really made it, you know, basically almost impossible for people to live. It's part of his program of driving them out. But it's more, it's also sort of, it's not just driving them out. It's like, hey, if they're dead, they won't come back and bother us. You know, and that's the kind of, I mean, the horrifying fascistic things that are going on that so many people don't even know about. And the fact that he has unleashed this whole assault. And again, I think it's perfectly, I think it's very important to call it a fascistic assault on immigrants and how they live, because that's actually what's happening. And so too many people in this country turn their head away from that.
Right. The United States has a lot to answer for in relationship to the rise of the right wing and of cartels in Latin America, in Central America and Mexico. And the Trump administration, John Bolton in particular, has played a role in ensuring that some of the very people that UN actors had sought to keep out of power in Central America have now moved back into positions of power and governance. And I think it's really important for folks in the United States to take a hard look at the aftermath of the wars in Central America that Reagan sponsored or Reagan backed in the 1940s, in the 40 years ago in the 1980s, 60 years ago. From the Contra War in Nicaragua and the role of the Contras in pushing cocaine north into the United States through Central America, the role of Plan Colombia under Clinton, the role of the Obama administration and Biden in continuing to consolidate Mexican cartels in the Northern Triangle, in Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, and that those cartels are increasingly running government, running the police, running the military. And so when Joe Biden and Barack Obama were in power, Joe Biden took responsibility for the Obama administration's Central America policy. That's why I name him, not just because he's running for president. But I think that we need to not just look to, are we going to vote Donald Trump out of office in November? That will or won't happen. But if it does happen, I think we also need to be mindful that that while the Obama administration was much better than the Trump administration in terms of supporting those in Central America who opposed the corruption, who opposed the cartels, who sought good governance in Central America and Mexico, we also have to keep an eye on the Biden administration, because a Biden administration, should there be one, because they also played a role in supporting police and military that were deeply embedded in the cartels.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one of the things that you talk about too, talk about even refusing medical care that is necessary for the survival of adults and children as well. And this is deadly. You know, you're talking about Trump, and he has really gone after the children a lot. I mean, this is something that people, it's hard to wrap your head around. He's actually gone after children. And actually, when children and others disappeared, it was more often not a product of state repression, which I think a lot of people don't even consider. It's something like, when I read that, it was kind of slapped me in the head. It's like, of course, state repression. They're going after the children. That's what it is. You can't call it anything other than that. That's the reality. And I think that people need to understand the importance of understanding that.
I've learned so much from talking to activists in Central America who, since the 1970s and 80s, have been pursuing the question of the disappearance of children and the disappearance of adults as well, but really thinking through what is the role of state repression in harming families on purpose. So in taking children from families and households as part of a counterinsurgency strategy. And it's really taught me a lot about how to think about the United States. That when I read about the role of white citizens' councils and state legislatures and governors in separating children from their families during the civil rights movement, in response to the Black Rebellion in the South and the North, all of a sudden I understood that what Central American activists were talking about in their country had also happened in our country. And so, of course, it was no surprise exactly to me when the Trump administration very explicitly began naming a strategy of taking children in order to prevent people from applying for asylum. For many people, it was a shock. The Obama administration had, in fact, talked about doing exactly that and said, no, we absolutely can't do it. And the reason that they can't do it, though, is a credit to activists in the United States. We have the long history of an abolitionist movement that focused on this question of the taking of children from enslaved mothers and families. We have a long history of calling out that kind of abuse. So during the civil rights movement, the Urban League organized a campaign, an international campaign, against the cutting off of federal benefits to mothers in the South who relied on federal benefits to feed their kids. They had an international campaign called Save the Babies. And so this kind of targeted violence, on the one hand, is wrenching and intimate. It destroys the sort of insides of families. And on the other hand, we have a history in the United States of activists calling it out, not as well-developed and sophisticated, perhaps, as the activists in Latin America, in Central America, and Mexico, who have called it out. But we can and have done this consistently.
Mm-hmm. You know, and as you're talking, I keep coming back to, again, this thing you've spoken to somewhat, but it just keeps coming up because it's, you know, you've described what's being done to the children as taking them as a strategy. And I really do think it's very important for people to understand this, because even just rolling off of that, you also talk about the outrageous Nazi character of Trump. You know, in the face of this, the horror that he's argued that you have to take the children away if you want to affect your political goals, in this case, these are very bad goals. There's no way of saying, oh, well, you know, he meant well. You know, the guy's a Nazi, and what he's doing to these children is incredibly, I mean, it just goes against every just bone of, I don't know what you'd call it. You know, it's you look at it and it's the most incredible fascistic thing that you can think of. What's happening to children simply because they're born in another country. They have a skin color that's darker than what the U.S. prefers. They have all this other stuff that's happening. And that basically, in the face of all of it, Trump says that, take the children away. If you want to affect your political goals, you got to do that. This is and in this case, these are very bad goals. It's important that people understand that these are very bad goals.
Well, and it's not an accident that the Trump administration, when it's looking for a signature issue in the political realm, has turned Border Patrol on Black Lives Matter protesters. And we saw yesterday the grilling of William Barr about essentially the disappearance of protesters in Portland, the whisking people into unmarked vans, which we also saw yesterday with the New York Police Department. But I think that the question of what effect does this kind of fascism against immigrants have on people in the United States, it should be very clear by now that as the Trump administration similarly deploys Border Patrol tactical units to places like Chicago and Albuquerque and St. Louis, that they are trying to generate a new kind of theater, a theater against Black Lives Matter protesters that reiterates the theater that they think worked well for them in taking children of migrants, of refugees at the border.
Yeah. You know, and I'm going to go back to this for a minute because it's also, you know, one of the things that you've been talking about, and I find it extremely important in terms of this, the Nazi character of Trump. And, you know, this, what we're talking about here, and I think you made this point, but this is about America and what it is, not about one fascist in the White House. You know, because it's like, yeah, Trump's, you know, you can say everything you want to say about him. He's one fascist in the White House, but there is an entire American regime that he couldn't do without that being a major part of it. And I thought what you said in the book about the Obama regime and the conditions facing immigrants then was extremely important, because people tend to sort of think that it was different. And there was some difference. You have an outright Nazi, but you also had, I mean, you know, Obama did what he could to actually keep the immigrants out, you know, and that's something that I think people should not forget. And there's the fact that adults and children were beaten horribly in the 9/11 attacks. You know, when you go that far back, you know, immigrant children and adults were beaten horribly as a result of the 9/11 attacks, you know, inside the U.S. because just because of who they were, what, you know, what nationality they were. This is the stuff that actually is sort of the cesspool that's running under and feeding a lot of, you know, the most horrible things in this country.
Well, I think it's super important that we take a long look at the apparatus we've built since the Clinton era against immigrants. And not only, as I was just saying, does that same apparatus get turned against U.S. citizens, even if you have a narrowly self-interested view of U.S. citizens should be treated in a way that resembles what we think of as constitutional protections. But we also have to have a long conversation, and a substantive one, about the role of U.S. immigration policy in creating a right-wing apparatus. And that it was a long walk into these woods, and it was accomplished by Democrats at least as much as Republicans. I mean, if you really want to start looking at the production of deportation and harsh apparatus against immigration, you wouldn't look to Reagan so much as you would look to Clinton. That, for one thing, funneling people away from border checkpoints and walking through the desert as a strategy for getting into the United States, that's a Clinton-era policy. And the good thing that has come out of the Trump administration is that his anti-immigrant policies are so crass and so sadistic that they've generated substantial opposition in a way that we haven't seen in the last 40 or 50 years in the United States. And so for the first time in a long time, the majority of people in the United States want more immigration. And they definitely think that we should be, as a country, more generous to asylum seekers. Those are sort of Gallup poll results. If we want to see the potential of those poll results, also Pew Trust, realized, then we need to keep moving this conversation forward about what kind of immigration policy do we want to see, not just in very conservative administrations like the Trump administration, very racist, let's be explicit, but also what do we want to see when somebody is better at framing this in the language of freedom, or, as Obama was, the rule of law. If we say it's in the service of all good things, can we still stand up for the kind of generosity that we as a people would like to see toward immigrants and asylum seekers?
Mm-hmm. You know, the thing is, and I think this is actually where we're going to end up sort of closing up in a minute, but I think it's important what you're saying, but I also think it's really important to understand, too, that, you know, that there's a concerted effort to break any hope that people have. Immigrants, children, especially, I mean, you think about the children, and that's what your book has centered on, Taking Children, A History of American Terror. And it really is American terror when you're talking about these kids who have, I mean, they're little kids, they're kids, young kids, even if they're teenagers, they're walking through the world in a way just exploring things that they don't know about, or just, and have to rely on certain, you know, on being able to go to certain people or certain things to understand this stuff. And what they're hit with in this country as they're trying, they're coming in with their families, they're torn away from their families, they're left, I don't think it's uncommon for families to never see their children again. You know, and I think that this, when you think about the horrors that have been unleashed on this, and this concerted effort to break any hope that people trying to get into this country, not because they just love America because it's so cool, but because they can't live where their home is, and they're hoping that they could get into a country where they might be able to squeeze out some existence and help, you know, take care of the folks at home. People have just refused to give up in the face of all the horrors that have been concentrated in this. And I think it's really, really important that people understand that, and understand that when you hear about raids on the border and things like that, that you understand what's really behind it and why people are doing it. And damn it, people need to stand up and support when people are standing up like this. They need to stand up and support them and say, no, we're not going to allow this to go on.
Well, that's right. And it's the thing that keeps bringing children to the United States is precisely U.S. policies. It's not only the role of U.S. policy in forming the shape of cartels in Central America and Mexico, but also the so-called hardening of the border, beginning with Clinton, means that many, many, many families are separated by the border. So unaccompanied children who are entering the United States are by and large entering in response to the fact that their parents are already here, or they have a sibling who's already here who is responsible for caring for them. And the more that the structural adjustment policies mean that the net balance of payments from Central America to the United States, the money is here. If people want to work and survive, they come to places like the U.S. and Europe. And if they leave their children behind, hard immigration policies, hardening the border, enforcing border policies means that in order to achieve family reunification, people need to bring their whole family to the United States. And at the same time, they are fleeing horrific violence. But they're also trying to keep their families together.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I'm going to have to say this. Laura, I really appreciate your book and appreciate you talking with us now. I want to remind people that we're talking with Laura Briggs about her book, Taking Children, A History of American Terror. Don't miss this, all right? This is something that you got to go out. Go out and get it now. Read it. Talk about it. Spread it around. Laura, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure.
Terrific.
All right, great.
All right.
Thanks a lot. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Elvis Costello with Goon Squad, a fitting introduction to my next guest, Mike Hasty. Mike is a photographer and a member of Veterans for Peace. Mike was part of the Wall of Vets at the protest in Portland, Oregon, when he was attacked and pepper sprayed in the face by Trump's very own Goon Squad. His story has been all over the major media, and he's joining us here today. We'll be talking about standing up to the fascist stormtroopers in Oregon and about the important work he does with the Full Disclosure Project, which utilizes the experience of Vietnam veterans to counter the government's attempts to whitewash U.S. atrocities in Southeast Asia so they can be free to continue with atrocities around the world. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for asking me.
Now, Mike, you're known worldwide as the Vietnam vet who stood up and called out the military force that attacked people protesting around Black Lives Matter and the mobilization of the military again. And basically, this is something that I thought really struck the world. And I wanted you to tell people what happened that day and why you felt so compelled to step out like that.
You know, one more time, it's been an accumulation of stuff that's been going on down here since the police and the protesters have been going at it. And so there's definitely been some abuse with the police. And, you know, I've been tear gassed multiple times. I had a projectile fired at me, and I was able to get out of the way while it went past me. And then there's been other people that, you know, have been injured really badly. I think that one of the main reasons why I did what I did is that my incident happened, I think it was Saturday, July 25th, if I remember right. And about 6 days before that, I believe, there was a Navy veteran by the name of Christopher David that was trying to exercise his First Amendment rights and talk to the police about why he was there. He's a U.S. Naval Academy graduate, 53 years old. And so while he was trying to talk to them, they directly sprayed him with pepper spray in the face. And then another cop took a baton and hit him four times. And I was just at the right position where I was able to get still photographs of that. So I think that's one of the things that, you know, motivated me to do what I did, because this has happened to me before where I've been in major demonstrations. And what I do is I step forward sometimes and I tell the police why I'm there. What's the reason for me being there? And I wanted those federal agents, those police officers, to know, you know, they represent, you know, this power, and, you know, they're supposedly defending the Constitution of the United States and serving their country. And so I just basically stepped forward and said that I that I was defending my country, but when I got to Vietnam, I realized that my government was committing atrocities every day. Now, that's all forms of weaponry, whether I don't care whether it's air power, you know, I don't care if it's artillery rounds coming from fire bases or Navy ships or Agent Orange or the Phoenix program, it doesn't matter. You know, one of the things you hear down there is that the protesters, the supposedly, you know, the anarchists, President Trump's calling them a beehive of terrorism, you know, and they're down there destroying property there at the Mark Hatfield courthouse. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, American people don't know when we go overseas in the third world countries that we destroy property with bombs, with jets, with artillery, with ground troops. And so that was one of the things that I wanted to say to those police officers. And then I had mentioned that there wasn't one day during the Vietnam War that the United States didn't commit an atrocity. And then after I said that, then that cop sprayed me directly in the face. And I think what happened is that when I got sprayed, I felt betrayed one more time by my government. And so what I did is I was able to regroup mentally, and so I repeated that twice again. And that was, I think, that what motivated me was two things. When Christopher David got sprayed and beat on, and then when the cop directly sprayed me, because I was just exercising my First Amendment rights, and he violated my First Amendment rights. So at that point, I stepped forward and I said to them, "This, I'm going to tell you a story." You know, I said, you know, your generation doesn't know what your government does overseas. And that's when I repeated it three times, that we committed atrocities every single day in Vietnam, which is the absolute truth. It's what is known as the unspeakable truth. And so one of the things that Vietnam vets do is that we expose national shame. And then after I repeated it three times, that's when I said that I stood next to a ditch in Vietnam where American soldiers murdered 170 innocent Vietnamese people. And that was at My Lai. I've been to My Lai three times. You know, I went back to Vietnam in 94, I went back to Vietnam in 2016, and then I went back to Vietnam in 2018, all three times at the My Lai Massacre. So I was at the 50th anniversary of the My Lai Massacre in 2018. So I'm compelled to tell the truth. And so when I did that, what happens when you bear witness? Because there's no rest for the messenger until the message has been delivered. So what I spoke as loud as I did is that there's countless people's voices are coming out of me. You know, I'm speaking for a lot of people who can no longer speak. I mean, more Vietnam veterans have probably committed suicide than served in Vietnam. 22 American vets commit suicide every day in this country. And then you have the millions of Vietnamese who were killed by our weaponry during that war, not only Vietnam, but Cambodia and Laos. So I am compelled to bear witness. It's something I have to do. I have to speak for those who can no longer speak. And that's what motivated me when I did what I did.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really important when you bring that out, because one of the things you also talk about is something along the lines of lying is the most powerful weapon in war. And in particular, yeah, you were speaking about that in relation to the systems, and when they're waging these wars, and there's always some excuse, there's always something that says, we are on the yeah, right side. And you make that point
right,
very powerfully, I think. Lying is the most powerful weapon in war. Let's talk about that.
Right. Well, it is. I mean, I finally realized that, you know, that one of the things I realized when I came back from Vietnam is that I realized that American corporations can't make a killing off of peace. You know, when I talk about lying as the most powerful weapon in war, which is a statement I wrote a number of years ago, is that when I came back from the war, you know, and I started examining Martin Luther King's speech that he gave on April 4th, 1967, you know, when he was at Riverside Church in New York City, and he made two profound statements. He said, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today is my own government. Okay. The second statement he mentioned was, he said, a nation that year after year spends more money on military defense than it does on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Okay. And another quote, which says, I just heard this recently by the Reverend James M. Lawson Jr. when he spoke at John Lewis's funeral. And you know, there's three ex-presidents that were in that room when he said this at the funeral. These are Lawson's words. He said, we will not be quiet as long as our nation continues to be the most violent culture in the history of mankind. I mean, you know, you can't get any more profound than what Martin Luther King said in 67, and then the Reverend James Lawson when he made that statement at the funeral of John Lewis on July 30th, just a few days ago. Once I realized that I was the enemy in Vietnam, my whole core belief system was dismantled. You know, I mean, I was raised in the military. My father was a career military officer. He was a combat veteran in North Africa. We were stationed in Germany and Japan and all that. So I was raised with a lot of patriotism. I was raised thinking that my country could never do anything wrong. So when I come back from Vietnam, I realized that my history and what I was taught was a lie. And so that's where that statement comes in from, that lying is the most powerful weapon in war. So I finally realized something, because it just seems like that a lot of people I spoke to, either they didn't believe me, or they dismissed themselves from the conversation, or their eyes got glassy, and I just felt like, well, there's something I'm not doing. Somehow I'm not communicating with people to get my truth across, you know? And then it dawned on me. This reality dawned on me after being back from Vietnam for probably 30 years, and I realized something. It was like breaking a code when I realized that whenever the truth threatens one's core belief system, there's an urgent need to deny its reality. And that's why facts don't matter anymore. You know, I finally realized that you do not bring the enemy to the peace table by just killing military combatants. You ultimately bring the enemy to the peace table by killing innocent civilians because they are military targets. That's how you break the spirit of the people. You murder their civilian population, and that's what the United States was doing every single day during the war in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mike Hasty, photographer and activist. Now, one of the things I wanted to, I know we're moving close to wrapping this up, but I wanted to actually tell you, one of the things that I saw that you've worked on that I thought was extremely powerful was photo essays. And that's what you've done a lot of in your life, is you're a photographer. Right. And let's talk about that. What is your photo essay thing about? It's the Army medic in Vietnam, that kind of stuff. It's something that was really powerful when you look at this. And it really, in some ways, it gives even more of an understanding of what was going on combined with what you've been talking about. And you see this whole photo essay that you have.
Yeah. You know, I got interested in photography when I was in Vietnam, you know, and so, you know, I bought a Miranda camera that I ordered from a catalog, and it was sent to me in Vietnam. So I started taking pictures, because sometimes I go into mountain yard villages. We would often go into mountain yard villages, which are ethnic minorities in Vietnam. We would go in and do med caps on them. Well, walking into a mountain yard village was like opening up a history book and flipping the pages back 2,000 years. And so I thought to myself, I have got to get this on film. So that's when I started, you know, doing my photography. And one of the main photographs I use, which is on the internet a lot, is that there was a helicopter, a dust-off helicopter in our unit. And the crew had simply taken white paint and they, in large letters on the nose of that dust-off helicopter, they wrote the word why, as in, why are we in Vietnam? And so I used that photograph a lot. One of the things I realized is the power of photography. It's like, you know, that statement, a picture is worth a thousand words, is so profoundly true. And so what I started doing is that often I would write one-liners, and I'd say to myself, I got to put a picture to this one-liner. And so what I would do is I would take a photograph, and then I would write something under the photograph. I'd write something kind of punchy and direct, you know. And then that's where, you know, I started writing things like lying is the most powerful weapon in war, and so many other things that I've written, you know, under photographs. And so that's what I do. Over the years, I can't tell you how many photo essays I've done. The last one I did was I did a photo essay on the My Lai massacre. And so I use verbiage, I use rhetoric that I put with photographs that creates that synergistic effect between the writing and the photograph. And so it, you know, so the writing enhances the photograph enhances the writing. You know, that's what I do when I take my photo essays around, and I've spoken at just about every high school in the Portland area, along with most of the colleges and universities. And so that's what I do. So I go into the high schools and I'll put all my photography on the lip of the blackboard. So usually I put like 8x10 photographs, and I mount them on 12x16 black mat board. And then under the photograph is text. You know, and I will display that text on the blackboards as I'm giving a lecture or talking about whatever it is that I'm talking about, an individual panel, because it's got, the panel's got the picture and it's got the text under it. So I just constantly tell stories. And so I have a picture of a friend of mine. I took a picture of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. And I have a really close friend of mine that saw heavy combat in Vietnam. And so we've all heard about walking point as the lead man in a detail or a platoon is walking through the bush. There's always somebody that's walking point. And, you know, they're always looking for tripwires. They're always looking for ambushes. And the rest of the group is a little bit farther back. Well, this friend of mine made a statement. He said, "I walked pointless in Vietnam." Imagine that, a combat soldier that was there during the Tet Offensive, who saw a lot of violence. He realized, just like I did, that the war was a lie when he came back. So that's when he made that statement to me. He said, "I walked pointless in Vietnam." And so I used that statement that he wrote, and I put it under the picture of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. And so that's the kind of stuff that I'll do. And it has an impact. And it's very effective, especially kids, as far as me explaining things. Like, I have a shirt that I wear often when I go into the schools. It has the word war on it in big letters, W-A-R, and they're red, white, and blue, okay, those three letters. And under it, war stands for wealthy are richer.
Right.
And that's what war is about. Our economy is based on theft and murder. Mm-hmm. And, you know, since the end of World War II, we have bombed 30 countries. You know, it's those kind of punchy statements that people remember, especially what I just told you. When I wear that shirt that says war on it, wealthy or richer, you know, I went to Japan about a year and a half ago with an Iraq vet, and we spoke to a number of peace groups and universities. And when I had that shirt on, the Japanese would come up to me, because when I talked, I would tell them what it meant. Then there was a Japanese interpreter that was telling the audience what that shirt meant. And the Japanese were turning up to me, and they were mentioning, you know, and some of those spoke English, that how powerful that statement was, you know, that it was simplistic. So I have a tendency to lean toward things that are simple. So I got a photograph, you know, less is more. When I'm cropping a photograph, I have to focus on what is the subject of the picture. And I eliminate other things that are not part of the subject. It's very effective, you know, because I absolutely have to simplify it. You know, otherwise people get caught up with too much information. So it's been very effective for me over the years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, I have one last question for you, and I think it's actually might be a little bit broader than just you, because it's talking about the Full Disclosure Campaign, which I know you're part of.
Yes.
And it's a program of Veterans for Peace. Now, you talk about that as an effort to speak truth to power and keep alive the anti-war perspective.
Right.
on the American war in Vietnam, which is extremely important. And you talk about full disclosure representing a clear alternative to what the Pentagon is doing, their current efforts to sanitize and mythologize that war and to thereby legitimize further unnecessary and destructive wars. Let's talk about that.
Well, I mean, they got to rewrite the history of the Vietnam War because that's what they got to do. In order to repeat the history, they're going to have to sanitize the war. They're going to have to say that there was a moral cause for us being in Vietnam, which, as we all know, is a total, complete lie. You know, and that's what they do. They rewrite history, constantly rewrite the history so they can repeat the history. You know, because one more time, what we're dealing with is shame. But that's what Vietnam vets do. We expose national shame. You know, the United States is a global empire. You know, we've got over 800 military facilities around the world. We represent 4% of the world's population, yet we have the most powerful military force ever known to mankind. You know, and I've often said that the most evil piece of real estate that's ever existed on the face of the earth is the Pentagon. And that certainly goes along with what James Lawson Jr. said when he said, "We will not be quiet as long as our nation continues to be the most violent culture in the history of mankind."
All right.
You know, and so that's what you got to do. You got to complete, you know, repetition is the mother of learning. Mm-hmm. We've got to continue to throw the truth in the face of and inform the American people that the United States is a global empire, and it's got to be stopped.
All right, Mike Casey, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hey. I appreciate it. Thank you. Bless your heart for taking interest in this, and I hope that what we've done today will have, you know, we'll certainly have some.
All right, that was Mike Casey, a photographer, activist, and anti-war Vietnam veteran, and we've been talking about the Battle of Portland and his work with Veterans for Peace. You can see some of his work at VietnamFullDisclosure.org. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to share your thoughts and ideas about the show, or if you want to volunteer to be part of the show, write to me at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And today, I want to go out with Imagine, in memory of John Lennon, who died 40 years ago this week. Talk to you again next week.